Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
For Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, friend of the court briefs, an extraordinary number of them, are filed with the Supreme Court questioning the detention of Al-Qaeda suspects at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Also, in the inner city, the most lethal killer, guns, drugs, try stress.
She's 48 years old. She had her first heart attack when she was in her late 20s. She has asthma, diabetes, gout, arthritis, and high blood pressure as well.
Researchers say a new drug dramatically reduces recurring breast cancer. And the FDA is considering lessening restrictions on silicone breast implants. These stories and booing Bruce Springsteen at Shea Stadium coming up Here and Now. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Anne Bozell. An Iranian lawyer has become the first Muslim woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize. Shireen Ebadi is a human rights defender. NPR's Nick Spicer has more from Paris.
Ebadi was on a trip to Paris to attend a conference on Iran when she learned the news. The steadfast defender of women's and children's rights said it came as a complete surprise, and that the Nobel Peace Prize award belonged to all the people who work for human rights and democracy in Iran. Ebadi was one of the first women judges in that country until forced out of office by clerics after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. She is now a lawyer and lecturer and said the prize gave her new energy to fight. Ebadi said despite abuses of the Muslim faith by political leaders, there was no reason to think Islam and human rights were incompatible. The Nobel Peace Prize Committee praised Ebadi for her defense in court of intellectuals and writers who have been victims of political persecution. Nick Spicer, NPR News, Paris.
Two American soldiers were killed and four wounded last night in Baghdad. The U.S. military says they were ambushed, but a Shiite cleric says the troops triggered a firefight. The Bush administration is seeking to counter growing criticism as continuing violence in Iraq claims more American lives. Today, Vice President Dick Cheney told the Conservative Heritage Foundation in Washington that the war was a critical strike against terrorists. NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
The Vice President's speech was the latest by top officials trying to once again make the case for war. Cheney said toppling Saddam Hussein was crucial because the Iraqi leader could someday have given terrorists weapons of mass destruction. He called that the ultimate nightmare, possibly leading to hundreds of thousands of American deaths in one day. The Vice President said while problems remain in Iraq, the world is better off.
There are terrorists in Iraq, yet there is no dictator to protect them, and we are dealing with them one by one. Terrorists have gathered in that country, and there they will be defeated. We are fighting this evil in Iraq, so we do not have to fight it on the streets of our own cities.
He said it would have been reckless not to have taken preemptive action. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush is promising to try to weaken the power of Cuban leader Fidel Castro. Speaking in the Rose Garden this morning, the president said the U.S. will make it easier for dissidents to flee the communist country.
We will better inform Cubans of the many routes to safe and legal entry into the United States. Through a public outreach campaign in southern Florida and inside Cuba itself. We will increase the number of new Cuban immigrants we welcome every year.
The president said the U.S. will also beef up travel restrictions to Cuba. Stocks are mixed at this hour. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 3 points to 96.83 in light trade. The Nasdaq is down a point, and the S&P 500 is down a fraction. You're listening to NPR News. In NPR's business update, the Labor Department reports inflation at the wholesale level increased by 0.3% in September. That was more than analysts had been predicting. It follows an increase of 0.4% in August. The Producer Price Index measures prices before they reach consumers. Last month's increase was fueled by a huge jump in food prices. Those were up 2.3%, the biggest increase in 8 months. Connecticut-based General Electric announced that third-quarter profits fell 11% from last year. The company cut its fourth-quarter estimates, but it also announced another major purchase. Member station WNPR in Hartford, John Dankowski reports.
GE says it earned $3.65 billion, or 36 cents a share in the third quarter, down from $4.09 billion, or 41 cents a year ago. And the company is blaming weak demand for gas turbines and higher costs at its plastics division for the lowered fourth-quarter guidance. The earnings news coincides with yet another purchase announcement by GE. They've agreed to pay about $9.5 billion for British medical equipment company Amersham. Officials say it points to a new trend in medicine, merging imaging technology and bioscience. Earlier this year, GE bought Finnish medical equipment company Instrumentarium. This week, GE strengthened its entertainment sector by agreeing to a deal with Vivendi to create a new company, NBC Universal, which will combine film, TV, cable, and production units into one of that industry's biggest powers. For NPR News, I'm John Dankosky in Hartford.
Checking Wall Street once again, the Dow is now up 7 points to 9688. Trading has been light. 465 million shares have changed hands. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness. On the web at melvilletrust.org.
I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. Several groups of prominent Americans have joined together to urge the Supreme Court to intervene on behalf of some of the 660 detainees held by the military at Guantanamo Bay. Seven separate briefs were filed at the Supreme Court this week, including one by retired U.S. diplomats, arguing that detaining prisoners beyond the reach of the law demeans and weakens this nation's voice abroad. Another brief by former military lawyers, including the former Judge Advocate General of the Navy, says that American failure to provide prisoners with the protections of the Geneva Convention may lead to other countries depriving American prisoners of those same protections in a future conflict. A group of former American POWs tells the court that those protections may have saved their lives in the past. And a group of former U.S. judges urges the Supreme Court to overturn a lower court ruling and give the prisoners the legal right to challenge their detention. John Gibbons is the former chief judge of the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Welcome, Judge Gibbons.
Pleased to be here.
Judge, you're one of the former judges who filed a brief before the court saying that the lower courts were wrong and that the Guantanamo Bay detainees should be able to challenge their status in court. What was the mistake, in your opinion, that the lower courts made?
Well, the lower court held that because the detainees in Guantanamo were in what it described as territory of Cuba as sovereign, the writ of habeas corpus, which is the time-honored method of challenging executive branch detention, did not apply.
Yeah, now you yourself served at Guantanamo Bay, did you not?
I did. I spent a year there.
So what do you think of the lower court ruling?
I think it's ludicrous to suggest that Guantanamo Bay, where the United States has a perpetual lease and where it has been in total control inside the fence for over a century, is not American sovereign territory.
Judge, is this unprecedented, do you think, that so many former judges, even Admiral Grutter, the former Navy Judge Advocate General, have joined together to challenge the U.S. government in court?
The practice of filing amicus briefs is not so unusual, but the collection of amicus briefs in this instance is really striking.
Can you describe, Judge, briefly what the former Judge Advocate General is saying?
What the former Judge Advocate General is saying is that these people are being detained not only in violation of the rule of law of the United States, but in violation of the laws of war that are reflected in the Hague and Geneva treaties. And what he and the others who signed that brief are concerned about is that if the United States chooses to disregard its international obligations with respect to the treatment of prisoners of war, American servicemen who become prisoners of war may be similarly treated by other governments.
What about the 19 former U.S. diplomats who filed a brief? What's their argument?
Their argument is that the foreign policy interests of the United States are being seriously harmed because the posture of the United States in the international community has always been, we stand for the rule of law. And here is a gross departure from adherence to the rule of law by the United States. How can we, with a straight face, ask other countries to abide by the rule of law?
Judge, what do you think the chances of these presentations to the Supreme Court succeeding are?
Well, review in the Supreme Court, of course, is discretionary. The practice of the Supreme Court is to grant review if four justices vote in favor. That doesn't decide, of course, the merits of the appeal. It only decides whether or not the appeal will be heard. I'm cautiously optimistic that there will be four votes in favor of review. And if the court takes it, I think it will be hard for a majority of the justices to write an opinion approving what's going on in Guantanamo, not only in Guantanamo, but also in the Navy brig in South Carolina, where an American citizen captured in Afghanistan is being detained without access to a lawyer.
Isn't there an argument, maybe it's not a legal argument, or maybe it is, that extraordinary times demand extraordinary measures?
Extraordinary times frequently lead to a breakdown in the rule of law. And the role of lawyers has to be, in extraordinary times, to insist on adherence to the rule of law. Nobody is suggesting that there aren't serious security concerns, but they can be addressed within the framework of the rule of law. There's no reason for excluding due process in the treatment of these people, and there's no reason for departures from the treaty obligations with respect to treatment of prisoners of war.
Judge John Gibbons, thank you very much for joining us on this.
You're quite welcome.
John Gibbons is the former chief judge of the 3rd U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Researchers testing a new way to use a breast cancer drug have had such success, they've halted research to announce their findings. Also, the New England Journal of Medicine was scheduled to publish the findings in its November 6th issue. The journal decided instead to put them straight onto their website yesterday. Well, joining us to explain what the excitement's about is our regular medical contributor, Judy Foreman. Welcome, Judy.
Hi.
Judy, what's the study all about?
It's an important study because right now, when you have breast cancer and you get treated, if you're postmenopausal, you basically get a hormone called tamoxifen afterwards to prevent recurrences. And it works basically pretty well if you take it for 5 years. More than five doesn't seem to do much good. So the question has been, what do you do for these women after that 5 years is over to sort of enhance their chances of doing well afterwards? And this study set out to answer that question. They looked at more than 5,000 women, and they gave half of them a placebo, a fake drug, and half of them this drug called an aromatase inhibitor, which goes by the name of Femara or letrozole. This drug basically prevents the conversion in the body of general male hormones called androgens into estrogen. And that's important because it's estrogen that seems to drive a lot of breast tumors.
There's a lot of excitement about this, isn't there? This will save lives, seemingly.
That's the hope. Right now, they only know that it prolongs disease-free survival, not overall survival. But it was such an important finding, as you said, that they stopped the study early. That's because, you know, they haven't had what they have wanted until now. And these aromatase inhibitors, and this is just one. There are two others already on the market. May really be the answer for a lot of women, although there are caveats.
There are caveats. What are they?
Well, Arimidex, which is another aromatase inhibitor, can trigger osteoporosis, and that's a very serious problem because when you shut off estrogen in the body, the bones need estrogen, and they really fall apart essentially without the estrogen. So that's a major drawback. Also, women on any of these aromatase inhibitors are going to get hot flashes and other menopausal symptoms big time.
Anything you can do about the problem with osteoporosis and hot flashes?
Yes, especially osteoporosis. There's a drug called Fosamax, and I haven't figured out yet whether if giving aromatase inhibitors as a standard post-tamoxifen treatment should always be accompanied by Fosamax, but that's a logical thing to do, and I suspect since all those drugs are on the market, doctors will start doing that fairly soon.
Judy, given that tamoxifen is only effective for 5 years, why not go straight to the aromatase inhibitors?
That's a really good question, and that's something that the researchers are now studying in other clinical trials. And that may be ultimately the way that we go. Right now, that data isn't there, so doctors are saying stay with tamoxifen for 5 years and then switch to the aromatase inhibitors.
When might we see doctors start prescribing this for women recovering from breast cancer who can no longer have an effective treatment with tamoxifen?
I would think very soon. At least it's something that women in this situation should talk to their doctors about. I think this is a very strong study. The drugs are already on the market. They're reasonably safe, and I would think doctors would start doing it quite soon.
Thanks so much, Judy.
Sure.
Judy Foreman is Here and Now's regular health columnist. Next week, the Food and Drug Administration will hold 2 days of hearings to decide whether to again allow the use of silicone breast implants in this country. In 1992, the FDA restricted the sale of silicone implants due to health concerns. But since then, the number of women getting breast implants in the U.S. has grown 7 times over, mostly using saline solution. Analysts say that if the FDA reapproves silicone, demand will increase even more because many women say silicone implants feel more natural. Well, joining us from Chicago to talk about next week's hearing is Dr. Rod Rorick. He's president-elect of the American Society of Plastic Surgeons. And welcome, doctor.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for joining us, doctor. Remind us why silicone implants were banned in the first place.
Well, the silicone implants were banned in spite of the fact that the FDA panel in 1992 approved them. But there was some concern about the science behind the safety of implants. And really what this hearing is doing is to look again at the science since the early 1990s. And we welcome the FDA looking at it because there's been a lot of science behind the silicone implant since then.
Well, tell us about that science.
Well, there's been several studies. First of all, the American Society of Plastic Surgeons, we support a process that promotes the safety and health of our patients, because after all, we're physicians first. And the science behind silicone implants is now shown, after more than 10 years of looking at it, that the silicone gel implants do not cause systemic problems like autoimmune problems. And that's been bore out in a study that was published by the Institute of Health in 1999 that basically said that they were overall safe. But there were some concerns, certainly, about how long they lasted and the local reactions. And I think the biggest thing we learned in that is that implants, like any other implants, have a lifespan, and they don't last a lifetime. They last about 10 to 15 years, and that needs to be part of the informed consent to women.
And that's the case with whether it's saline or silicone? They only last a certain amount of time?
Exactly. Silicone or saline. They last between 10 and 15 years. And in my own personal experience, that has borne out to be about 13.4 years in a study that we did at the University of Texas at Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas.
Why is it important, though, to bring back silicone? Why not just stay with saline?
Well, because if they're shown to be safe, then it allows a woman to have a choice. We're one of the only civilized countries in the world that doesn't allow women to have a choice in the type of implant they put in. And also, silicone implants look and feel better, especially in patients that don't have very much breast tissue. It's interesting that today they're only allowed to be used in breast reconstruction and breast cancer patients, and they've been shown to be very effective in those patients. Mm-hmm. And what hopefully these hearings will show is that it's safe to use in all patients.
Doctor, just to finish up, do you care which implant you use?
I don't care about which implant we use as long as it's safe and effective and patients are happy with it.
Hmm.
Dr. Rod Rorick is president-elect of the American Society of Plastic Surgeons. And thanks very much, Doctor.
You bet. It's my pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Just ahead, stress can kill you if you're poor and living in an American city. And later in the show, the nine Democrats eyeing the White House try to break away from the pack. Did anyone make the break? More coming up here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. When the subject is how deadly urban slums in America can be, you might imagine that means drug overdoses and gunshot wounds. But in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine, journalist Helen Epstein explores what's even more lethal for America's urban poor. It's not shootings or drugs or AIDS, not diseases caused by germs in dirty air, bacteria, viruses. The real killers are heart disease, kidney disease, diabetes, asthma, and cancer. And the victims are young, 48, 22, 36, among the ages of some of the people Helen Epstein spoke with. And Helen now joins me on the line. Welcome, Helen.
Thanks.
Helen, thanks for joining us. So it's not necessarily primarily crime that's killing people in the inner city. Heart disease, diabetes, cancer, high blood pressure, those sound like afflictions of the affluent.
That's true. The leading causes of death do seem to be these chronic diseases that we generally associate with either the elderly or with the affluent. Rates of kidney disease can be three times higher in neighborhoods like Bushwick in Brooklyn, which is a very poor black neighborhood, predominantly African-American, compared to the Upper East Side of Manhattan, which is where movie stars live. And that's age-adjusted, meaning that at any given age, the rate is three times higher for diseases like stroke and kidney disease and so on.
So what are the theories? Why?
The main theories fall into two classes. One that's getting a lot of attention at the moment in this country is that these people are subject to high levels of stress, and that the hormones that people generate when they're subjected to high levels of constant stress actually degrade and harm the tissues of the heart, the brain, and other organs. The other theory is that it has to do with the environmental conditions in which people live. Exposure to dirty air and lack of healthy food in their neighborhoods. We hear a lot of talk about how people need to get control over their diets and quit smoking and so on, but it's very hard for people in poor neighborhoods to do that, partly because it turns out that in many cases, fresh, healthy food is more expensive in poor neighborhoods than it is in rich neighborhoods. It's also harder to find. The first full-service supermarket in Harlem was apparently built after 2000.
Tell me about one case you write about, Beverly.
Beverly is an African-American woman living in a housing project in Yonkers, New York. She's 48 years old. She had her first heart attack when she was in her late 20s. She has asthma, diabetes, gout, arthritis, and high blood pressure as well.
And what does she think could cause such a terrible spectrum of illnesses in someone so young?
Well, a terrible spectrum of assault, really. I mean, her brothers and sisters also died young, several of them, and so she ended up raising 10 children all on her own, and then she had to get on disability because she was so ill, so there really wasn't much money around. life was a constant worry, and she was terrified that the kids were going to be dragged into crime, and one of them actually was recently killed right outside her window. Mm. She experienced a lot of racism, which she perceives as racism on the part of the police, which was quite stressful to her and makes one feel that there's no one on her side. And plus, the public housing itself is quite a dangerous atmosphere in some ways. I mean, in some of these housing projects in New York metropolitan area, 30% of children have severe asthma. She said that for years, an incinerator used to burn the garbage and spew this black dust into the air, and every single day you'd have to polish the furniture to get it off, and she wondered how much of that was getting in people's lungs. She said that every year she goes into the hospital with severe asthma. Hmm.
Compared to crime, how much more deadly is disease in the inner city?
In a sense, they're kind of related, I think, partly because the stress of living amidst so much crime actually probably contributes to a lot of chronic diseases and a lot of stress-related diseases. Crime in the 1980s was a terrible problem, but what's interesting is the way that a lot of these health problems actually began to get worse around the time of and since the crime epidemic. So it's almost as though these rates of asthma, diabetes, even rates of tuberculosis in the 1980s all seem to follow the crime wave.
They dovetail. Any solutions out there? You mentioned a moving to opportunity study where people were moved to less impoverished areas and their health improved. Is that an answer? Or?
Well, I think that's part of the answer. Yes, that was a housing and urban development demonstration project, very small scale, but they took poor women and their families from public housing projects and moved them into middle-class areas. And researchers weren't actually looking for effects on these people's health, but they found them. And the results are quite preliminary at the moment, but more results are expected soon. And it looks as though that's one possibility, although that's quite a difficult task to achieve, to empty out the slums. I mean, what makes more sense is to improve the conditions in which people live, to really invest aggressively into these poor neighborhoods. Hmm.
Helen Epstein, thanks very much for talking to us about this.
All righty. Pleasure.
Helen Epstein's article, Enough to Make You Sick, appears in this Sunday New York Times Magazine. She spoke with us from Brooklyn, New York. And this note about living conditions on the planet beyond the U.S. Right now, according to a new U.N. study, 1/6 of the world's population live in slums. 1/6. That's a billion people. By the middle of the century, if trends continue, the U.N. says, more than half of everyone living in a city will live in a slum. The problem's most severe in sub-Saharan Africa, where 3 out of 4 people live in urban slums. Among the reasons cited by the UN are war and globalization, but also indifference. The report says little efforts now directed to finding work for the urban poor, nor planning for services and housing that will only be more desperately needed as populations continue to explode. There are a few places where housing conditions are improving. The UN points to China, Thailand, and Singapore. Next week on Here and Now, you've heard of Candid Camera. Well, an American labor union has sent out young filmmakers with camera in hand to film the Democratic presidential candidates off the cuff, up close and personal. We'll talk to some of the young filmmakers about what they saw. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. Coming up, Arnold is governor-elect now, thanks in part to Jay Leno providing an unusual stage for a politician.
I just wanted to tell you, I was in a neighborhood. I was in a neighborhood, and I said to myself, I want to come by as a little surprise visit.
And the new film, Kill Bill, carnage done with dark humor.
There's a baseball diamond where I coach our little league about a mile from here. We meet there around 2:30 in the morning, dressed all in black. We have us a night fight. Now, I have to fix Nikki's cereal.
These stories coming up, Here and Now.
I'm Steve Brown. Iranian activist Shirin Ebadi is the surprise winner of this year's Nobel Peace Prize. Ebadi is the first Muslim woman and the first Iranian to receive the prize. She was also the first female judge in Iran.
It's a right reading of the Quran and of Islam. Then you realize that is not because you're a Muslim that you cannot accept and respect the human rights. That's basically it. So I think that all the real religious people, all the real Muslims, they have to be welcomed to Christ.
Ebadi says the award doesn't only belong to her, but also to all the people who work for human rights and democracy in Iran. The International Red Cross is condemning the prolonged detention of U.S. military prisoners without legal rights at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The agency says mental instability and attempted suicides indicate severe problems with the U.S. operation. White House spokesman Scott McClellan says the detainees are being treated humanely, saying, quote, and I remind you, these are enemy combatants. President Bush is trying to intensify the economic pressure on Cuba. In a Rose Garden ceremony, the president announced a crackdown on prohibited travel to the communist island nation.
No tyrant can stand forever against the power of liberty, because the hope of freedom is found in every heart. So today we are confident, no matter what the dictator intends or plans, Cuba será pronto libre.
The president says the reason for the travel crackdown on Cuba is a new wave of repression last year by Castro's government. Observers say it may also be a response to criticism from the Cuban-American community in Florida, a politically important state that Bush has not done enough to bring democracy to Cuba. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat went to Muslim prayers at his West Bank headquarters today, reportedly kneeling and getting to his feet without help, looking stronger after what doctors called a bout of stomach problems. 74-year-old Arafat appeared pale, haggard, and seemed disoriented earlier this week. There was some speculation Arafat had stomach cancer or had suffered a heart attack. 390 flight attendants at American Airlines are going back to work. They were put on furlough last summer as part of cost-cutting measures by the airline to avoid bankruptcy. It's the company's first employee recall since the 9/11 attacks. On Wall Street today, stocks are mixed. The Dow is up 4 points at 96.84. NASDAQ is even at 19.12.
I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young is away. It's Here and Now. The line between news and entertainment blurred a little more this week when late-night television host Jay Leno introduced California Governor-elect Arnold Schwarzenegger on Tuesday night, not as a celebrity megastar plugging a new movie on The Tonight Show, but at Governor-elect Schwarzenegger's victory party.
Ladies and gentlemen, the governor of the great state of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger!
All All right. Well, a day after his big win, Governor-elect Schwarzenegger, who declared his candidacy on Jay's show last month, stopped by again to joke about how Leno looked a bit bored during his victory speech.
Just remember, never call me, and I'm going to check right away your tax returns.
Really? Get up.
Well, not to dampen the festivities, but should a talk show host watched by millions so obviously declare his political slant? And then there's Arnold's other biggest fan, his journalist wife, Maria Shriver. Can she now remain an objective NBC journalist? Meanwhile, in other political news, how about those nine Democrats running to unseat President Bush? They debated again last night. It was at least a bit entertaining at times. Here's General Wesley Clark saying there really ought to be a more civil tone among the candidates, after which he immediately attacked the other candidates.
I'm not going to attack a fellow Democrat because I think everybody on this stage shares the same goal. I think it's really embarrassing that a group of candidates up here are working on changing the leadership in this country and can't get their own story straight.
Well, to get this straight story, we're joined on the line now to talk about Arnold and Jay and Maria and the debate by two members of our editorial roundtable. Guy McMillan is editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. And welcome, Guy.
Thank you, Bill.
And Randy Wilson is editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona. Hi, Randy.
Hi, Bill.
Well, Guy, just to start with you, here's Jeff Zucker, NBC's chief entertainment executive, about Jay Leno. He said, I was aware Jay was going to do it. I did not and do not have a problem with it. Should he have a problem with it?
I think we've gone way past that. No, I don't think he should have a problem with that. I think if Jay Leno wants to identify himself with Arnold Schwarzenegger, that may be to his benefit. It may not be, but I don't know that it does any harm. I mean, nobody complains that Rush Limbaugh lets his political leanings slip every once in a while on his radio program.
Yeah, but Jay's got this forum of millions and millions. There's kind of a tradition in late-night TV. Johnny Carson never declared who he liked politically. David Letterman never has. Randy, recent Pew Research Center polls show about a third of young Americans get their news from late-night hosts. What do you think?
Well, if that's the case, then I would say they're not too well informed, but that doesn't mean it couldn't change. If politicians realize that a younger group needs to have some humor and some political bite to get their news, maybe it's time that we in the news media change too. And, you know, what about a late night format in prime time?
Yeah, spice it up a bit.
Sure.
I'm not sure that's a good idea, but I did notice that a funnier line than Jay Leno has had for months was spoken on yesterday's debate by John Kerry when he said there's only two ways to get prescription drug coverage in this country. One way is to hire Rush Limbaugh's housekeeper, and the other is to elect him president. I thought that was a great line. I mean, if politicians can be that funny, Jay Leno is going to be out of work.
Listen, besides Jay Leno, Maria Shriver, just very briefly, guys, can she be an NBC journalist now, so attached to the governor-elect, Republican governor-elect of California?
She, too, I think has to walk the fine line, and probably it's going to be more as an entertainment reporter, which I guess she's done some profiles. And if she sticks to that and probably has to stay out of California, she probably can pass it off.
I don't think NBC should have any problem. She can go back to journalism. She does have a little bit of a credibility problem now, though. She didn't distinguish herself very much with the press bashing that she tried out on the campaign trail.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
She said stories about her husband's groping of other women were an example of gutter journalism. And I guess the implication is that it's more reprehensible to report on an attack on a woman than to actually attack one.
Well, let's look at the debate. This was the most fiery debate we've seen among the Democrats. Most of the contention focused on frontrunners Howard Dean and Wesley Clark. Clark, after his pretty bland debut in a debate a few weeks ago, was much more fiery last night, like this moment when moderator Judy Woodruff asked about his alleged flip-flops on the Iraq War.
But I think that's a very clear answer, Judy.
But you acknowledge there were some changes in your statements about Iraq after you announced as a candidate.
The answer is very clear. The answer is I would have voted for a resolution that took the problem to the United Nations. I would not have voted for a resolution that would have taken us to war. It's that simple.
Well, is it that simple, Randy? Is the general finding his stride here or still kind of confusing?
he's still fairly confusing. It really shows why these debate formats have sunk to a level of kind of sound bites and actually unreality. It's as if no candidate has ever had any contradictions.
Yeah. Well, former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, guys, was a bit less of a target last night than General Clark. In fact, he even seemed to be kind of trying out a new message. Let's listen to that.
Let me tell you what the answer to the question is about why the Democrats aren't winning. It is because we don't stand up for what we believe in. Why do you think I am where I am, having come from no place at the end of January? It's because I've gone out and given 50% of Americans who have given up on voting in this country a reason to vote again. We can't just change presidents here. We're trying to change America.
Always a bit of an edge when Howard Dean talks. But what did you make of that, Randy, that kind of call for unity?
I think it's actually just playing on his image as the outsider still, and that standing up is actually a code word for standing up to the insider politics of Washington.
Who do you think did well last night? I'm afraid I'm going to keep the handicapping up. Did General Clark do what he needed to do last night? Did Howard Dean maintain his lead?
I think Dean did well and Clark did not do well. I think Dean, for one thing, did not lose his temper last night. He was prepared to joke about having once been compared to McGovern, now they're comparing him to Gingrich. That was a good line. And Kerry, who does have a presidential demeanor at times, I think, would probably do better if he didn't spend so much time criticizing Dean and accusing him of throwing old people out in the snow.
Randy, what do you think about John Kerry? He's got a heck of a resume, but he doesn't seem to be breaking out.
He certainly hasn't broken out here in the West. I think he's seen as a product of a kind of standoffish East Coast attitude, and it may just be the way he presents himself, and that's not fair. But again, in these debates, image really does matter, and I'm not sure he improved that last night.
Now, Guy, just to finish up, I'm sure you'll be contemplating all these highfalutin political ideas and completely ignoring the fact that the Red Sox are poised on the verge of turning history on its head this weekend?
Hey, let me tell you, last night was the toughest night. I was up all night with VCRs humming, and I suspect I'll be glued to the TV set over the weekend as well.
We expect the Sox to beat those hated Yankees, too. They spent most of their series putting down Phoenix and our lack of subways and hot dogs. So, go Sox.
Thank you both. Randy Wilson is editor of the Arizona Daily Sun in Flagstaff, Arizona. Thanks a lot, Randy.
Thank you, Bill.
Guy McMillan, editorial page editor of the Keene Sentinel in Keene, New Hampshire. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
You're listening to Here and Now. You can face serious penalties for drunk driving in this country, but it wasn't a crime anywhere in the United States to get behind the wheel dangerously tired until last August. That's when New Jersey became the first state to outlaw driving too tired, when the state legislature passed Maggie's Law, which made falling asleep at the wheel in certain circumstances a crime. Joining us on the line now from Turnersville, New Jersey, is Carol McDonnell. She's the mother of Maggie McDonnell, a 20-year-old woman who was killed by a man who fell asleep at the wheel and then paid only a $200 fine for his crime. Welcome, Carol McDonnell.
Thank you.
Carol, thanks for joining us on this. To start, what happened that got you so motivated that you've now made a law in New Jersey?
Well, we had a great injustice in the courts in New Jersey. The man that killed Maggie had been awake for 30 hours, partying in a crack house. He was a totally impaired driver. He admitted in court he knew he was too tired to drive, but he chose to disregard his fatigue, got behind the wheel, witnesses followed him. For miles, he was weaving in and out of traffic, dozing on and off, and finally he crossed three lanes the highway and hit Maggie and killed her. And we were in court 40 times over a 3.5-year time period. We had two murder trials. The first trial was a deadlock jury. The second trial, he was acquitted as the defense hammered to the jury over and over. There is no law in the state of New Jersey stating you can't sleep and drive. And he received a $200 fine, which would have been the same if he hit a tree.
And how did you get the law passed?
I went to the legislators in New Jersey. I started with Assemblyman Geis at that point, and then I went to Senator Sweeney. They introduced it in the Assembly and the Senate, and the Senate had passed unanimously. in the assembly, it passed overwhelmingly 74-4. And finally, 6 years after Bangi's death on August 5th, Governor McGreevy signed it and made it official in the state of New Jersey that it is against the law to fall asleep at the wheel and kill someone. However, there's two elements to Maggie's law. Number one is you have to be awake 24 hours or longer. As research has proven, if you're awake 24 hours or longer, your motor skills are equivalent to being legally drunk. And the other element is there has to be fatality. It's not just being tired and driving. It's a matter of being totally impaired and then killing someone.
What would have happened to the man who killed your daughter if this law had existed?
Right now, if he did it today and killed Maggie, he would get 10 years in prison and a $150,000 fine for a crime from a $200 fine.
Carol, are other states inspired by what you've done?
Yes, they are. I understand Washington and New York have contacted Senator Sweeney, and also I've been invited to Louisiana next week to go give a speech. They're interested in it. So it's not only a problem in New Jersey, it's a problem all over the nation.
Carol, what kept you going amid just such inconceivable grief?
Well, I just couldn't ever get a peace when I'd sleep knowing this man killed my daughter, got away with murder, and because it was an inadequate law. And I think it was a little bit of beginner's luck and an angel on my shoulder, Bill.
Carol McDonald, thank you so much for joining us on this.
Thank you for inviting me to tell my story.
Yeah, and we congratulate you for your determination despite the terrible tragedy in your life. Carol McDonald, thanks again.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Carol McDonald joined us on the line from Turnersville, New Jersey. She's responsible for the new law in New Jersey, Maggie's Law. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bill Delaney. It's Here and Now. In Hollywood, cutting a movie can break a director's heart. But Quentin Tarantino seems to have cut himself a rare deal for his new film, Kill Bill. He got the green light to split the three-hour Asian-influenced epic into two 90-minute serial films. Volume 1, starring Uma Thurman as a former assassin bent on revenge, opens today in theaters around the country.
You have every right to want to get even.
Get even? Even, Stephen? I would have to kill you. That'd be about square.
Kill Bill is Quentin Tarantino's first film in 6 years. Here and Now's film reviewer Eric Schaefer is in the studio to give us his good word on Tarantino's return. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Bill.
Well, Eric, 11 years ago, Tarantino ushered in a new era of kind of ultra-hip, ultra-cool, ultra-violent filmmaking with Reservoir Dogs.
Right.
That was followed by Pulp Fiction. His last picture was Jackie Brown, which came out 6 years ago. And since then, there have been rumors around Hollywood that maybe he'd reached his peak and was even all washed up. What do you think? Is he back strong? Tarantino still the king of cool?
I don't know if I'd necessarily call him the king of cool, but he's certainly back strong. Jackie Brown, I think, was a bit of a disappointment to a lot of his fans. But with Kill Bill Volume 1, he is certainly back on track.
What's the story? What's the plot?
Well, the story is complete pulp. It involves the bride, the character known as the bride, who was part of this elite assassination squad run by Bill, who was also her lover. And she left that group, and on her wedding day, great with child, Bill and the rest of the assassination squad come back and they kill the wedding party and they think they kill her. But she's actually just in a coma. She wakes up 4 years later and she's bent on revenge.
So when do we do this? It all depends.
When do you want to die? Tomorrow? The day after tomorrow?
How about tonight?
Where?
There's a baseball diamond where I coach our little league about a mile from here. We meet there around 2:30 in the morning, dressed all in black. We have us a knife fight.
12 weeks, it ended up being 8 months of shooting. And Harvey Weinstein, the head of Miramax, calls it just a fun B-movie. That's an expensive B-movie.
It's a real expensive B-movie, but most of it is up there on the screen. The action sequences are really quite incredible. And the thing that's really exciting about it, I think, at least from an action movie point of view, is that it's basically all done with real people. It's not like The Matrix Reloaded, where we had the scene with all the Agent Smiths coming at Neo. And you could really tell that a lot of that was digitally done. In this case, we're talking about expert fight choreography done by Yun Bo Ping, who also did the fight choreography for The Matrix. And it just is really a standout in terms of the action sequences.
Eric, how does Uma Thurman hold up in this martial arts film?
Uma Thurman is really great. She is both vulnerable in the scenes where she needs to be vulnerable, and she is deadly in the scenes where she needs to be deadly.
How violent is it? I mean, Tarantino's films have all been violent, but sometimes almost with a comic book edge, which seemed to take some of the edge off it.
This is probably one of the most violent mainstream movies I have ever seen. Mm. But it is sort of undercut by some of that black humor that Tarantino is known for.
So, worth all the hype? There's been a lot of it and all the money?
I think it's going to be a movie that's certainly going to appeal to movie buffs. You know, Tarantino himself is this massive movie buff. So certainly for people who are fans of spaghetti westerns or martial arts films and so on, I think they're going to eat this up.
Eric Schaefer on Kill Bill. Thanks, Eric.
Thank you, Bill.
Here and Now film critic Eric Schaefer reviewed Kill Bill, Volume 1. Now, Here and Now co-host Robin Young is away today, but she left us this essay.
I went to see Bruce Springsteen in concert last weekend, and I know it's hard to believe, but the boss got booed. Here's what happened. It started off well enough, an ecstatic, sold-out crowd at New York's Shea Stadium, members of my tribe. As a native New Yorker, I loved hearing how he was doing. Even the roar of the crowd when Bruce came on had a New York accent. He played Candy's Room and A Brilliant Disguise, and then Waiting on a Sunny Day from his 9/11 tribute CD, The Rising. During an a cappella call and response, Bruce would sing something, the audience would sing it back. Which is hard, by the way. Shea Stadium is so big, it was more like a round or a musical wave. But when Bruce ad-libbed, "Waiting for a new president," it happened. The first boo. It was small. In the massive crowd, you could barely hear it, but it was there. At first, I wasn't sure. I mean, the crowd always yells, "Bruce," and that could be confused with boo, but no, it was definitely a boo. Then later, Bruce dedicated a song to James O'Shea, a firefighter who'd died the week before, the first New York firefighter to fall in the line of duty since 9/11. His widow said he'd had a ticket to the show to celebrate his 41st birthday. She asked Bruce to remember him, so he did, then launched into the achingly beautiful Into the Fire.
May your strength give us strength. May your faith give us faith. May your hope give us hope. May your love give us love. May your strength.
How holy, I thought. How reverential. How... My thoughts were interrupted by the big state trooper standing next to me yelling, "Yeah, first the firefighter song, then the cop song is next." Well, it turns out, a few days earlier, Bruce played his song about the death of Amadou Diallo, who was shot by New York police when they thought he was reaching for a gun. At that show, the entire police contingent walked out. And Bruce had also been pitching Al Franken's Bush-bashing book and protesting the war in Iraq. But Bruce Springsteen had long gone from songs about Cadillacs to songs of social protest. Didn't his New York fans know that? Why was he getting booed now? Why here? Sitting at center field at Shea, we faced the ocean, planes taking off from nearby LaGuardia Airport, passed right behind Bruce as he sang of waking up after 9/11 to an empty sky. Thank you.
where you used to be. I want a kiss from your lips. I want an eye for an eye. I woke up this morning to an empty sky.
Maybe because the attacks happened here, this is the last place that wants to be lectured about peace. I heard one woman yell out, "Shut up and sing." Before the many encores, Bruce acknowledged the discord. He said something like, "Listen, this is a democracy. When boys and girls are dying, people have to be held accountable." And then he slammed into Born in the USA, nipping any booze in the bud.
Born down!
It was a great concert. No one left. People loved it. It's just that it was so cold at Shea Stadium. Really cold. Wind blowing in off the water. And there was another chill.
Can't see nothing in front of me.
I couldn't help but think, the last time I'd been there for a concert, it was 1963. The Beatles. We stormed the stage. My friend Debbie Cubbage got Ringo's drum cover. Concerts were so much simpler then.
Sky of blackness and sorrow, dream of love. Sky of love, sky of tears, dream of love. Sky of glory and sin, dream of love. Sky of mercy, sky of fear. Sky of memory and shadow, dream of love. Your burning wind fills my heart tonight.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Bill Delaney. Robin Young will be back next week. Get into your radio and join us again. Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney. Join us next time for the news in these stories here and now. A labor union dispatches young filmmakers to follow around the Democratic candidates for the presidency. And what do tribute albums and file sharing have in common? That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.